From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Celeste Headlee. It's Here and Now. The Department of Justice is launching gun trafficking strike forces to address gun violence and stem the flow of illegal firearms in five regions around the country: New York, Chicago, Los Angeles, the San Francisco Bay Area, and Washington, D.C. Deputy Attorney General Lisa Monaco spoke about the program yesterday in Washington.
We all know that our job is to go after those who pull the trigger and end up critically injuring and, in some cases, murdering innocent people. But our job is also, of course, to go after the sources of those guns, the corridors that they travel in.
This is the latest in a series of initiatives by the Biden administration and the Justice Department to try to reduce violent crime, which has been on the rise around the country. Joining us with more is NPR Justice Correspondent Ryan Lucas. Hi, Ryan.
Hi there.
This initiative is apparently not targeting areas that have seen perhaps the highest spikes in gun crimes, but trafficking corridors instead. How did they choose these five places?
Well, these are five areas that have certainly seen their own problems with violent crime. Chicago, for example, where the Attorney General Merrick Garland is kind of launching this initiative, has seen a huge spike in violent crime and shootings and in homicides. There were 200 more homicides in Chicago thereabouts in 2020 than there were in 2019. So these are certainly places that have seen their fair share of a rise in gun violence, which is why these are being focused on. And the way that the Justice Department talks about this effort is that it is a focus and a sustained focus on coordinating and going after firearms trafficking. And the idea is to disrupt an entire network of firearms trafficking from where it begins, where the guns are originally bought, to where they end up being used in violence. And this isn't just about throwing resources at a problem. This is about bringing the focus of prosecutors, investigators who are already in place, already in these five regions, to ensure that they can try to clamp down on the sort of violence that we've seen.
Although there's not actually a federal law against gun trafficking, so how legally do they go about stopping trafficking?
The way that this works is, to a large extent, from what Justice Department officials say, is it ends up being paper crimes. People say lie when they are filling out the forms to buy, legally purchase a weapon. People act as straw purchasers, so buying weapons for individuals who cannot legally purchase a gun. The way that this strike force operation is going to work is about connecting where these guns are being purchased and then where they're actually being used in violence. Usually what you end up seeing is prosecutors in places where there's a straw purchaser or somebody lies on a form, they don't prosecute that because it's a paper crime. It's not really a big problem. But what the Justice Department is saying now is that because those guns are then being used in crimes someplace else, the idea is to connect where that gun is being purchased from where it's being used in violence to ensure that the people who are lying on forms or legally purchasing a weapon for someone else, that they get prosecuted as well. So it's a more holistic approach than what we've seen previously.
The Attorney General has said this is not just going to coordinate with local law enforcement and federal prosecutors, but really wants to emphasize on a partnership with community organizations as well. What have been the response from some of these communities?
Well, first off, I think it's worth saying that this is certainly a different tone from the Justice Department under the Biden administration than we saw from the Trump administration. There was not an emphasis put on community partnership and community prevention of gun violence the way that we have seen out of this administration. So there is a change in tone. There is still, you know, there is encouragement from many community partners to this sort of approach. But I think there's also a wait and see moment right now among gun prevention advocates to see exactly how this is all going to play out. And of course, there is a lot of apprehension right now in communities, particularly communities of color that are affected by gun violence, about interacting with the police. So it's a very fine line that the Justice Department and the Biden administration is trying to walk.
We only have a few seconds left, but has the Justice Department said anything about what might be causing the recent spike in violent crime? Overall, I know the violent crime is down in many cities compared to a decade ago. What's causing the new spikes?
It's very difficult with crime to attribute it to one specific thing. Researchers certainly point out that the spike coincided with the coronavirus pandemic. So there may be some indications that that has played a role. But again, it's very difficult to attribute it to any one specific thing.
Ryan Lucas is NPR Justice Correspondent. Ryan, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, to Provincetown, Massachusetts now, the vacation destination on the end of Cape Cod, popular with the LGBTQ crowd, making headlines for a cluster of COVID-19 cases that's emerged following the July 4th weekend. Unusual because two-thirds or more of these positive cases are people fully vaccinated. So what's going on? Let's bring in Vera Harik, Barnstable County Deputy Director of Human Services and Acting Epidemiologist. Vera, you've been working on COVID-19 response since the beginning. So how'd you feel when you saw these numbers?
Crestfallen, certainly, to see these case numbers jump so significantly. We were anticipating the possibility of case increases, particularly in hotspots for culture and nightlife like a place like Provincetown. And so even though we were prepared for, you know, to see some case increases, as we saw last summer, we are concerned to see that the increases were far in excess of what we had expected.
Right. Dr. Shira Doran, who's an infectious disease physician and epidemiologist at Tufts, said the cluster is so unexpected, not what we've really seen anywhere else. And she's concerned that there's some sort of hole in our knowledge of the current state and what's to come. What does that mean to you? I mean, it just doesn't seem consistent with what people know.
I'm certainly not willing to go as far as she might in terms of suggesting, oh, well, maybe there are other variants here at play. You know, our working assumption at this point, and it's subject to genetic sequencing of samples by the DPH, which is underway now, our working theory here is that this is the effect of the Delta variant. Some of the work we've seen coming out of Israel suggests that the Pfizer vaccine, in the face of the Delta variant, is only 64% effective at preventing infection than the prior, assumed rates of 95%.
Cape Cod's a huge, beautiful place. And this cluster is just happening in one spot. I mean, Provincetown, idyllic in some parts, but also it is a place where people go out and dance in packed clubs. Mm-hmm. Is there something maybe about that?
Candidly, yes. I mean, look, we are not packed cheek to jowl here on Cape Cod on the beaches. You know, the density of the population on Cape Cod in the summer is somewhat limited by the amount of residential inventory available for people to stay. And the density of that sort of inventory is quite significant in Provincetown. Over the July 4th weekend, bars and clubs were packed. And when you have that kind of density in the face of a respiratory infectious disease in variant form that we assume is present, you find yourself with the outcomes that we have here with the Provincetown cluster.
So public health officials taking this seriously, there's a new mask advisory, a recommendation that people show proof of vaccinations to enter crowded indoor areas. And this is one of the most highly vaccinated places in the country, you know, this area.
Yes.
And we do know that they will be the best masks possible when they don them in Provincetown. But in the meantime, right now, does this also show that, in fact, the vaccinations work? Because even in this cluster with this incredible contagion, there's only mild illness so far.
You're right. It is showing that the vaccinations are working because the illnesses are almost entirely mild. There have been 3 hospitalizations as a result of this, but it is a cautionary tale for people that of the Massachusetts cases that we have, 69% of the cases that have tested positive are among fully vaccinated people. So just because you're vaccinated does not mean that you should stop taking common sense precautions, particularly when you're indoors.
Okay. Well, of the, you know, over several hundred cases, most of those are Massachusetts residents. You know, about a third, it sounds like, live in Provincetown. People should be aware if they were in Provincetown, I'm assuming, that they may be carrying virus to others who aren't vaccinated.
The Department of Public Health has issued an advisory, you know, for people who have been in Provincetown during this period of time to monitor carefully for symptoms and in some cases to proactively be tested to make sure that they are not ill. I do know that the Department of Public Health is having many, if not all, of the samples associated with this cluster, or as many as possible, genetically typed to make sure that we understand which variants are in play in terms of infection. Again, our working assumption is the Delta variant at this time. There might be others. We will see. And this is also a national story because we have people in the cluster who were visiting Provincetown during the reference period and since have traveled home and have become ill. And so we have the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention working closely with our State Department of Public Health to make sure that the localities to which the people traveled to from Provincetown mm-hmm. are being followed and that their particulars are being recorded for the cluster investigation.
That's Vera Harik, Deputy Director of Barnstable County's Department of Human Services. She's also the acting epidemiologist during the pandemic there on Cape Cod. Vera, thank you so much.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Whether it's the bootleg fire in Oregon ripping through communities and leaving nothing but ash, or the tragic condo collapse in Miami, many people in America are safe and sheltered one day and homeless the next, their home and possessions destroyed in either natural or man-made disasters. We hope that we're never in that position. But the truth is, crisis can reach any of us one day. So we wanted to ask, what do you do after you lose everything? We'll walk through some practical first steps to take, and we'll start with the legal side of rebuilding. Kathy Grunewald is a disaster coordinator attorney with the Legal Services of North Florida, which is an area prone to destructive hurricanes. Kathy, welcome to the show.
Hi, Celeste. Thank you for having me.
So let's imagine I've been a victim of a fire or maybe a tornado. I have gotten myself removed from an area that's dangerous. I'm safe. My family members are all safe. What are the first three things I can do in order to move forward and recover?
You're right. The first thing you should do is make sure that you and your family and your pets are safe. Assuming that you could get back to your house or your residence, you should go back if you've had to evacuate and check for damage to your house immediately after. And I'm talking about storms because that's what we're most familiar with here in North Florida, hurricanes. And then start to take pictures of your property. Take pictures inside your house, outside your house, all around your house, and your surrounding land that you live on. But also take pictures before the event. You're going to need those soon if you're going to be applying for assistance or if you have insurance and you're going to need to file a claim. And then start paying attention to the local media for information on whether and where a disaster recovery center is going to be set up, a family or assistance center, or just some place that you can now start to register for disaster relief assistance.
So you've talked about relief assistance. Often that comes from FEMA. But mm-hmm. in insurance claims, do I need a lawyer to represent me when I'm filing for an insurance claim of this magnitude?
Well, you don't need a lawyer to file your claim if you have a homeowner's insurance. You may need a lawyer if after filing your claim, you're not satisfied with the response that you get from your insurance company.
What about the important documents I may have lost, things like Social Security cards, marriage certificates, birth certificates?
And that happens a lot. And so one of the first legal issues that people have after a disaster is document replacement. Hopefully, before the disaster, you have made a copy of everything and kept it in a secure place or taken it with you. But if you haven't, you'll have to replace those documents. And for some of those, you may need legal assistance to get them. For things like your driver's license or your Social Security card, you can go online if you have power and you're able to get online with the computer or the Disaster Recovery Center and make applications request that those be replaced. For other things, if you've lost like your birth certificate or a deed to your property, you may need some assistance with that. Or, for example, if you've lost information about if you're receiving SNAP or food assistance, you may need legal assistance for that. And legal AAA programs are in disaster recovery centers, and so the attorneys are there to answer questions about replacing those important documents.
What other kind of things can I do proactively so that the arrival of a disaster isn't made more complicated?
One, as I already said, is get your papers together and protect them. Also, get an evacuation kit. If you have to leave your property, you can expect to probably be away for maybe 3 to 7 days. So have the supplies you need for those 3 to 7 days. Clothes, medicine, things that you might need for a pet or for your children. Make sure you've got those. You can pick them up and go. Make sure you've got your insurance information before you leave. Also, make sure you tell friends or family where you're going so that they can contact you or look for you, or you can contact them and let them know that you're safe.
Kathy Grunewald is Disaster Coordinator Attorney with the Legal Services of North Florida. Kathy, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
We've been talking about the physical world of rebuilding after a disaster, insurance claims, replacing legal documents, but we also want to touch on the mental and emotional side of rebuilding as well. Daisha Williams knows that road to a sense of normalcy well. In 2018, the deadliest and most destructive wildfire in California, the Camp Fire, swept through her town in Magalia, burning her home to the ground. Today, Williams lives in Chico with her two sons, Dominic and Anthony, and teaches counseling and life skills courses at Butte College. Daisha Williams, thanks so much for being back with us.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to talk to you today.
So I wonder if you can think back to your emotional state in those days following sort of the shock, right? I mean, I have to assume that when you lose a home, when you have to escape a fire, there's a period of shock and disorientation. And then what?
So you're right. There's definitely shock. And I think the length of time for that is different for everyone. So it's probably important to note that everyone's going to respond differently. And then following that, it's just really a sense of being overwhelmed was kind of universal. I've talked to other survivors that have had sort of the totality of it hits you. Wow, we literally have nowhere to go and you're in survival mode.
And interestingly enough, at that moment when you might be overwhelmed by the feelings of grappling with all of the things that have happened and that you have to get done, you kind of have to be super efficient and effective as well. There's so many things that you have to do. And you're a single mother. You also had to be looking after the well-being of your sons as well. So how did you do that?
I'd say one of the hardest lessons, especially if you are really independent prior to a crisis happening, is learning to accept help. Help with places to stay. We had to get help financially. We had to get help from Red Cross. We just had to get help with everything. That's just really how you do it. There, people will line up to help, and you just kind of have to be willing to say, okay, well, now I'm on the other side of the fence. And if I accept all of this help, things will start to come together a lot better.
There had to be moments when you were maybe feeling better, and then you remembered something that you loved that was gone.
Absolutely. It's a process of grief. And I remember before thinking, as long as we get out okay, everything else is just stuff. But then when you go through it, you realize, wow, some of those things were my kids' art from preschool that I'll never get back. You'll go to put on your favorite pair of jeans and you'll remember, oh, wow, yeah, I just don't have those anymore. Or you'll have your first Christmas and you'll go to set up a tree and realize all your special ornaments are gone.
I mean, we keep them because they help us remember, right?
Right.
And then we lose them, and there must be a fear that you'll forget. And I wonder, for someone who might be going through this tremendous sense of grief, as you described right now, those who are affected by the Bootleg fire in Oregon or the condo collapse in Miami, what could they do today that might help them cope, that might help them get through this?
Yeah, it's a good question. And I've kind of outlined it, because when you've been through something, ultimately at the end, your hope is that you can pass on information to help other people. So I would say, you know, early on, accept help from others and then be open to redefining your life. Don't compare your life right now to how it was before. And there are practical ways to do those things. So it's like how I tell my students, I'm never going to just say, oh, think positive, it'll get you through it, without telling you exactly how to do that. So there are some strategies of how to get through it. And so if you like, I'd love to break some of that down into just practical ways.
Yes, absolutely.
So for me, and you know, they've done empirical studies as well, showing that practicing gratitude can really help you tremendously to get through a rough time. And there are easy ways to do that. So you could keep a little journal. You could start a gratitude jar. And every day you just identify something simple that you're grateful for, log it in your journal, or stick the little piece of paper in a jar. And you can start out with easy things like, I'm grateful for this cup of coffee, or I'm grateful that I made it out alive. I'm grateful that I have a place to sleep tonight. And then you just build on that. And the nice thing about a gratitude list or jar is that then later, if you're having a really rough day, you can go back and read all the things that you've documented that you're grateful to have. Prayer or meditation. And I use the word meditation, and actually even prayer, lightly. You know, you don't have to be in a room on a rug with a candle lit and chimes. You can just take a hike somewhere and be out in nature, and somewhere that you can kind of quiet your mind or quiet your spirit and just be in the moment. And I get it that in the beginning, you're going to kind of be in survival mode, but those types of practical things add up to make a big difference and help you get through those hard moments.
That was Daisha Williams, a survivor of the 2018 Camp Fire, the deadliest and most destructive wildfire in California's history. Daisha, thank you so much for sharing with us.
Thank you for having me. I really, really appreciate it.
Investigations into police use of force and misconduct were secret in California until now. We've sifted through hours of interrogation tape to find out, who does the system of police accountability really serve and who does it protect? Listen now to every episode of the new podcast, On Our Watch, from NPR and KQED.
The latest COVID-19 relief package includes $20 million to help preserve indigenous languages. But some say this money is too little and comes too late. Savannah Marr of the Mountain West News Bureau reports from New Mexico.
11-year-old Mililani Suina knows that the Karis language is sacred. She only shares a few words in the two dialects she speaks, from the pueblos of Cochiti and Santo Domingo, which she calls SD.
A Karis word for cookie, which is bakuwet, but in SD they call it kuwetba.
Mililani is a student at the Karis Children's Learning Center.
Our school is very special.
That's because everything from math and science to Pueblo history is taught in Karis.
I feel very lucky that I learned it at a very young age, and I'm still speaking our sacred language, because some of our relatives don't really know about our own language.
Mililani's mom, Phoebe Suina, says that for most of her life, she was one of those relatives who struggled to communicate in Karis, even though her adult relatives were fluent speakers. She says they were survivors of the Indian boarding school system.
When they spoke Karis, they were scolded because they were taught that in order to excel in the mainstream education system, it's only English.
We talk about historical trauma. Well, I guess you could call this linguistic trauma.
That's Christine Sims, director of the American Indian Language Policy and Research Center. Sims says this federal investment in indigenous languages is long overdue.
A lot of the things that have happened to the demise of languages have happened by way of the federal government and federal government education. So why not hold their feet to the fire?
In a typical year, the federal government gives out about $12 million in grants to a handful of indigenous language programs, leaving the majority of applicants without funding. But this $20 million emergency fund is non-competitive, and with more than 200 applicants, that means each is likely to end up with $100,000 or less.
You know, that's not even hardly a drop in the bucket.
Sims says that's not a transformative amount of money, especially compared to how much the government spent trying to eradicate these languages. Curtis Chavez agrees. He's the development director at the Karis Children's Learning Center. He says the most effective tools for language revitalization, like the full-day immersion school he helps run, are also the most expensive to operate.
You got to think about your staff. You got to pay them a salary, the supplies and materials, also the building itself to keep it running.
Chavez says the Karis Children's Learning Center runs mostly on private donations and grants, with federal support coming only sporadically through that highly competitive grant program. He says it should be easier for programs like the Karis Children's Learning Center to access federal funds.
I think it's owed to our people from stolen land and resources and such.
For families like the Suinas, keeping the school afloat is about breaking a cycle of cultural dispossession. Mililani says that she and her little brother Marshall, who's also learning Karis, love to share the language with their mother.
My mother is still trying to learn our language, so she's like encourages us to like speak our language so she can learn too.
And Phoebe Suina hopes her children will continue to be her teachers.
I have this dream that when I'm hopefully a grandma sometime in 20, 30 years, that I will just be speaking Karis.
She says that if the federal government could pay for her older relatives to attend an assimilationist school, it should pay for her children and grandchildren to reclaim their language. For NPR News, I'm Savannah Marr in Albuquerque.
According to the CDC, heat now causes more deaths in the U.S. than hurricanes, tornadoes, or floods. Climatologists say an average of 1,500 people die from heat-related causes in the U.S. every year. And a 2015 report from the climate change group founded by Michael Bloomberg says Florida alone is going to see an additional 1,840 deaths a year related to heat in the next 5 to 25 years. That's one of the reasons Miami-Dade recently announced that Jane Gilbert, Miami's former resiliency officer overseeing sustainability, would be the city's new interim chief heat officer. And heat officer Jane joins us now from Miami. I'm sure you hear this. How hot is it?
So our temperatures are in the high 80s, but here we have very high humidity. So you have a feels-like temperature of 106.
Yeah, we know that on Sunday, June 22nd, the heat index reached 108 degrees. That's the highest it's been since August 2015. So heat officer, what does that mean?
My role is to coordinate and accelerate our existing efforts to mitigate heat-related risks, particularly to human health and to outdoor workers, and to work very closely with our office resilience to make sure it's integrated with our plans to reduce carbon emissions as well as to adapt to sea level rise.
Well, I'm so glad you said that about workers, because there's a heat suffering gap that has become very noticeable across the country. There are people who can come to Florida and spend the day in the sun and the heat and then go home to frigid hotel rooms. But you have workers, construction workers, any kind of outdoor worker, who can't get away from it. So there's a difference in how people view heat. But you've told us that often they don't think about it at all. You call it the silent killer. Why is that?
So because heat-related illnesses, hospitalizations, and deaths are often underreported. You mentioned an estimate of 1,500 a year, but there are estimates as high as 12,000 a year that are deaths that are related to heat. But it hasn't been front and center in people's understanding of how dangerous it is.
Right. What do you plan to do about it?
So we have both the short-term actions that we know we need to do, which is one, increase our awareness and make sure that particularly our most vulnerable populations, so that could be elderly, certainly in low-income areas, outdoor workers, pregnant women have more vulnerability to heat. So to make sure that they're getting the information about what they can do in the events of heat. And it really is not only impacting outdoor workers, but people who can't afford to put their AC on at night or when in the heat of the day. So this heat over time is going to exacerbate those for those that can't afford or because of their work conditions can't be inside air conditioning.
Okay, you mentioned air conditioners. What do you do about that? Because we know that they contribute to global warming. And, you know, I always get annoyed at how frigid Florida's hotels are. They're so cold. So what do you do about that inequity that there are people just sucking up air conditioning in some parts and people who can't afford it in another part of the county?
So we need to first invest in energy efficiency and weatherization programs for the housing of the greater than 50% of our population that's struggling to make ends meet here. And when you talk about those that are using more AC than perhaps they even need, that's going to have to ultimately be their own responsibility. We can't regulate that, but it's an education.
What about infrastructure and planting trees and putting grass on roofs? I mean, what else might you do?
So tree planting does more than just provide shade, because it not only has the cooling impact of the surrounding area and any buildings it may shade, but it sequesters or absorbs carbon from the atmosphere, and it helps with stormwater management, which is also a big challenge here. So we've set a goal of realizing a tree canopy of 30% by 2030. We're going to be really concentrating those tree plantings in areas, our urban heat islands, that can have a temperature differential of 10 degrees Fahrenheit, just because it's a lot of pavement and lack of trees in and around playgrounds, bus stops, areas where people really need that shade the most.
You told the Washington Post that you can have a difference of 35 degrees between sitting under a tree in Miami and sitting in a paved area.
Yeah, in the middle of a parking lot. Yeah, it can be that dramatic.
Oh, boy. And just briefly, we know that you're partnering with Athens, Greece, which is working on this. What have you learned from them?
One of the things that Athens, Greece has done is used social media and apps to inform their public about where they can cool off. And that's one of the things that we are looking to do, is gather stories, and have already been engaging our public in installing temperature and humidity sensors in local areas in their communities so that everybody can be involved in monitoring the changes that we're seeing.
Yeah. And just finally, we know that increased heat means rising sea levels, warmer water, warmer air that holds the moisture, all that stuff. We're reading that Miami-Dade contains 26% of all U.S. homes at risk from rising seas. That's amazing. That's Zillow's accounting. Will that be in your wheelhouse?
So I work very closely with our County Office of Resilience and Chief Resilience Officer Jim Murley. My work will be completely integrated with that work, as well as with the team's efforts on reducing carbon emissions in the county.
I'm just wondering, Jane Gilbert, again, Miami-Dade's first ever interim chief heat officer. It's a temporary position that feels like it might become permanent. We have to remark also that you just had a building collapse in your state, just a horrific moment. You've got these record-breaking heat, rising sea levels. Do people feel a little embattled?
So I live in a community with many people who have fallen in love with Miami just as much as I have. So it is hard. You know, COVID's hit all of us, and then Surfside was just terrible tragedy that we're all still recovering from.
Yeah. Jane Gilbert, best of luck to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, a quick moment now for an update on a story. The Senate Armed Services Committee has approved comprehensive legislation that will reform how the military handles sexual assault cases and other serious crimes. A big victory for New York Democratic Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, who's been gathering bipartisan support for this legislation since 2013. Here she makes the case in 2015.
It's time to move the most serious crimes like sexual assault and murder out of the chain of command and put them in the hands of the most capable people in the military: independent, impartial, highly trained, uniformed prosecutors.
Earlier this year, Senator Gillibrand got key support from Republican Senator Joni Ernst of Iowa, who's a combat veteran and a sexual assault survivor. Right now, accusations of crimes committed by service members are brought to a commander who doesn't have legal training and often knows the suspect, and that commander ultimately decides whether or not the case goes forward. In May, our colleague Tanya Mosley spoke with Colonel Don Christensen about this potential conflict of interest. He's the former chief prosecutor for the Air Force and president of Protect Our Defenders, an organization dedicated to ending sexual assault in the military.
No matter how fair a commander is, they will have developed an opinion about the person that's under investigation. And that could be a good opinion or a bad opinion, but it's going to impact their decision-making. And that's why, you know, in the civilian world, we have people outside of the investigation who makes the decision whether to prosecute or not.
Senator Gillibrand says her legislation would mean criminal justice attorneys would handle these cases rather than commanders. And she says she has the votes to pass it in the Senate, although there's still some opposition in the House. And General Mark Milley, chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, has dropped his opposition, and other military officials have agreed that some reform is needed. The bill awaits that Senate vote. We'll watch here and now.
It was 8 years ago this month that a simple hashtag led to a global movement against police brutality and systemic racism. Hashtag Black Lives Matter was created in 2013 by three black women, Alicia Garza, Patrice Cullors, and Opal Tometi, after the acquittal of George Zimmerman in the shooting death of Trayvon Martin in Florida. Last year was a watershed moment for the BLM movement, when spontaneous protests erupted across the country and the world. After the murder of George Floyd in Minnesota, it was a moment of racial reckoning in the United States and elsewhere. To talk more about the movement, we're joined now by Melina Abdullah. She's a co-founder of Black Lives Matter LA. Melina, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
I said it, you know, it was a moment of racial reckoning, but here we are celebrating an eighth anniversary. Do you feel as though there has been steady progress with the BLM movement?
Yeah, I mean, we've been steadily building Black Lives Matter for more than 8 years now. And I think that, you know, it's telling because when we first convened to form Black Lives Matter, what our pledge was to build a movement, not a moment.
So 15 to 20 million people, they say, participated in Black Lives Matter protests just in the U.S. last year. But I looked it up. There were BLM protests in more than 4,400 cities worldwide. How do you sort of wrap your mind around how big this movement has become?
I don't know if we can wrap our minds around it, but it's really encouraging that so many people all around the world are willing to stand up and say we have to end systems of state-sanctioned violence. We have to not just say Black Lives Matter, but do work to make Black Lives Matter. And more than the protests, they're also building towards it. I think about work like Defund the Police, which is really about reducing police budgets and simultaneously building systems like mental health systems, like educational systems, like housing that actually make communities safe. So again, protest, yes, but protest is just the tip of the iceberg. The work is really what's below the surface.
How has it been for you? You know, I read a magazine article that called you the scourge of the LAPD. And at one point, you were charged with 8 criminal misdemeanor counts stemming from activism related to Black Lives Matter. How has it been for you sort of dealing with being a spokesperson?
Well, that's one of my most coveted titles. I love that. I love to be the scourge of LAPD. I don't consider myself to be a spokesperson. Of course, I'm happy to speak on behalf of the organization, on behalf of the movement, but the majority of my work is actually organizing with thousands of people in Los Angeles and around the country to, again, transform the system of public safety under which we live.
Just a month ago, former police officer Derek Chauvin was sentenced for the murder of George Floyd. How do you view this incredibly tragic death that also sparked these worldwide protests that we've been talking about?
The murder of George Floyd is representative of more than 1,000 murders that are on record that happen at the hands of police every single year in this country. But then we also think about the murder of George Floyd as one of the most horrific murders that we've ever seen at a time when we couldn't look away. And we were also encouraged by the way the entire community and world stood up and said, you will not do this to our people. And of course, who keeps coming up for me is the 17-year-old girl, Darnella Frazier, who refused to allow the city, the police department, and all of those who protect police, including police associations, to get away with lying about what happened to George Floyd, and bravely videotaped and made sure the world saw what happens at the hands of this kind of violent form of policing that plagues our community.
Although, sadly, Darnella Frazier's uncle was struck while he was in his car by a Minneapolis police squad car just a couple weeks ago and killed. I wonder, as we celebrate, I hope that's the right word, the 8th anniversary of Black Lives Matter, where do you hope you are in 8 years from now?
Well, 8 years from now, we hope that, and we're working towards, again, a fundamentally transformed system of public safety. We still want to defund the police everywhere we can. We hope that people are plugged into their own power. That's what this last year and some change has represented. Those are the things we're looking at, and of course, that begins with ending things like qualified immunity, disrupting the power of police associations, which are not unions, and investing again in the things that actually make communities safe.
Melina Abdullah, co-founder of Black Lives Matter LA. Melina, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Celeste Headlee.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.